Before I welcome Ian to come and speak to us, let's just pray. Loving God, we thank you for your creation that you've given us. And as we think tonight about the issue of food, we thank you for your gift of food to nourish us and everyone on this planet. And as we think about issues of justice and how people can be fed and the practicalities of that, pray that you'll guide us and challenge us and renew our faith in you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks, Bill. As Bill has indicated, it's a double act tonight, and I'll be providing some input to begin with, and hopefully I'll get over and done with before Tony has... So Tony has plenty of time to talk, because this is the first time I've met Tony Renato. I've known about him, and it's a great pleasure. Looking forward to hearing him talk about his the wonderful work he's been involved with. Just to keep the theme going, this is about caring for creation in Christ, and I hope that Ian's back there so we can communicate, hopefully. I'm going to show just three little clips of people who I think are quite inspiring in relation to this, just to provide some background to before Tony talks. But first of all, our theme again is caring for creation in Christ. And as I've tried to say each time, that our calling, our fundamental calling, is to be God's image bearers in his good creation, creative expressing his purposes for the creation. It's our story, the gospel story, isn't one about how we can escape from this material world, but how God wants to transform it and renew it and make it a place where he can dwell. And that we're part of that. We're part of that process. And through the gift of God's grace and through the Holy Spirit, we're enabled to be the kind of people, the kind of image bearers that God wants us to be. And we reflect on this in terms of being stewards of creation. It's a gift that we're given not for ourselves. We are called to be lords of creation. We have a mandate to actually reshape or shape the creation. But we're also priests. That wonderful example that Tom Wright had about being a two-way mirror, that we both reflect God's character and nature into this creation, but also we reflect the creation's praise back to God. But this is a nice theological vision, but in fact we need to live it out in the context of a planet under pressure, which is a term used by a whole group of climate scientists. Just this week, you might have noticed that the synthesis report from the IPCC major report came out, and it sort of just came and went without much of a blip, basically saying that we're on the irreversible process to a major changes in our world. Oh yeah, let's get back to something more topical. So we have this background of awareness, and also just this week, Graham Turner and colleagues have published a study which says the Club of Rome report back in 1970s, Limits to Growth, is basically on track. We're actually following through one of the scenarios, the worst case scenario. So we really are in a planet under pressure. How do we respond to that? And I've said, well, let's focus on our lives as consumers, because fundamentally that's what we are in relation to our material world. And so we're dealing with a question of affluence and convenience, but we have a sense of being disconnected from the processes of production, which we talked about last week. And I wanted to focus on those two aspects. On the one hand, the challenge of changing our own lives in the midst of our very particular situations to reflect God's purposes, but also the challenge of the larger systems of which we're a part. And we talked about food a bit last week, but this week we're focusing more particularly on food, again with those two sort of dimensions. So first of all, the challenge of food consumption. We're all consumers of food. And as first worlders, we're in the affluent part of the world, we have an ambivalence about food. We have the blessings of abundance and convenience, as I talked about last week. It's fantastic to live in our kind of world, a trip to the market to buy all our goods, and to go to the supermarket and so forth. But nonetheless, there's that sort of nagging discontent because it's all commodified. You know, we're not part of the production process. We sort of feel as though we should be more involved. We also feel guilty about the inequality of our world. We're in the stuffed part of the world and the starved part of the world. So there's this sort of huge and grotesque inequality in food production in our world. And we're also anxious about the food production systems. We realise that there's corporate control and we're worried about health and safety and so on. In response to that, and perhaps I can just take the next slide. This is just in relation to the what's behind the brands. In fact, this comes from an Oxfam report called Behind the Brands, like Behind the Barcode, showing, and this is an American, I think it's an American context, showing that amongst the enormous variety of brands of products, there are 10 big food companies that control much of the lot. So one of the anxieties we have is a sort of narrowing of control or centralisation of control throughout the whole food system. So that's one of our worries. So in response to these kind of nagging worries, there's a burgeoning food movement. And next slide, Ian, is... and one of the key figures in this movement is a guy called Michael Pollan. People come across him at all? Yeah. He was the leading driving force behind that film Food Inc., which had quite an impact about American food system, which thankfully is, well, our system is nothing quite like that. But nonetheless, he's been someone who's written quite extensively about the food movement, which has emerged partly in response to this kind of discontent. And so we see that coming up in the whole local food movement, urban farming, community gardens, the slow food movement, which I think is quite wonderful. Carlo Petrini, the Italian writer, who in response to McDonald's in Italy, they started a slow food movement, which was about the aesthetics of food, the culture of food, but was also about the larger political economy of food. That's a good example. Community-supported agriculture, organic farming, fair trade. It's a very large and diverse, eclectic movement that's happening. There's also a growing interest, which thanks Ian for the next slide, a growing interest among Christians about food issues. And that's a bit dark to see, but on the left is a book by Norman Wurzbach, who is one of the leading Christian theologians talking about food issues, food and faith. He's at Duke University. And a lovely title, Eat with Joy, Redeeming God's Gift of Food by Rachel Marie Stone. These are just three examples. The third one I put up there because that's by Simon Carey Holt, who is the senior pastor at Collins Street Baptist Church, Eating Heaven. Simon is a qualified chef and a real foodie. What I wanted to show you a little bit of how Christians think about eating. This is Norman Wurzbach has teamed up with Fred Barnson, who is on this clip, and written a book called Making Peace with the Land. And Ted Barnson, in a short TEDx talk, talks about his own journey. So thanks. He goes on to talk about three very interesting examples, but because time is short, you can follow this up, of course. Just Google Fred Barnson and... Soil and Sacrament, and you find a YouTube clip and it'll be there. It's a wonderful story actually, because he didn't mention it, but one of the reasons why he was asked to come there was that in that particular community, I think it's called Cedar Springs maybe, there'd been a shop there with a biracial couple, but the guy was murdered. They're not quite sure what the reason was, and no one was found the perpetrator, but it was a sort of interracial conflict. But instead of sort of becoming a vendetta about who did it, the woman who owned this block of land, the widow of the murdered guy, said, "I'd like to use this land as a form of reconciliation," and that's what it became. So he was hired to create the garden. So it was making peace with the land, but also making peace in the community. So that's a sort of example, and as he goes on to say, there's a sort of whole food and faith movement that's burgeoning in North America and around the world. That's on the one hand what individuals are doing in relation to the challenge of consumption and becoming more engaged in food issues, and last week we talked about Craig Goodwin. But we're going to focus more on the challenge of the global food system. As I mentioned in my note, over the past century, we've been blessed by developments in industrial agriculture that have made massive improvements in human health, human nutrition, and hence a huge increase in population and also productivity. And indeed, the kind of world we live in now couldn't have happened without major developments in agriculture, particularly in terms of synthetic fertilisers and so forth. And so we need to have that legacy. But this system has now evolved into something much more problematic. We have a globalised system. It's industrialised. It's much more vertically controlled by a relatively small number of large corporations. It's centred more and more on capital and energy-intensive production of commodities to be traded in global markets for processing and distribution to world consumer markets. So it's still very productive, but it's actually become much more kind of problematic, both socially and ecologically, and I think spiritually as well. And Raj Patel's book, Starved and Stuffed, picks up this kind of this huge inequality, because the starved and stuffed metaphor is that the number of obese people in the world now is as great, if not greater, than the number of desperately hungry people. And that's because the system drives increasing consumption of processed goods and so forth. And so there's the question of how we respond to that. As the metaphor of planet under pressure suggests, despite its capacity to produce lots of food, it's a system under pressure. Destruction of supporting ecosystems, the vulnerability of crops to diseases, climate change is a major driver, fossil fuel dependence. It depends crucially on the continual availability of cheap oil. And as well as that vulnerability, there's a problem of distributional inequity. And so it's a system in crisis, as many people say. And so the key question that we need to think about, and I think we all need to think about, even though we may only be minimally aware of what's going on, is what kind of global food system do we need to be more ecologically sustainable in the long term and socially equitable? They're crucial ones. And we would add as Christians also that it's spiritually honouring to God. Do we need, and in a sense there's two fundamental directions. The existing paradigm is one where we have lots of technology and we look to more intensive technologies that can continue to produce the volumes of good for world markets, commodities for world markets. That's the present system. It dominates the world. It's still in place because oil is still pretty available. Or do we need a development of a diffusion of an alternative agroecological paradigm? And that's the one which I'm going to suggest is what we need, and to look at some of that. So, Ian, the next one, I think, is... I'm not going to be able to read that, but this is from a major report about the impact of climate change on food production produced by... a whole bunch of worthies, including and headed up by Sir John Beddington, who is the UK chief scientist. And this is basically saying we have a food system in crisis and the challenge that we face. And it lists the sort of things that need to happen. The amount of food required, if I can take it up partway through, will be even greater if current trends in diets and the management of food systems continue. We need to make concurrent efforts to establish climate-resilient agricultural production system, make efficient use of resources, develop low-waste supply chains, ensure adequate nutrition and encourage healthy eating choices. Together, these will constitute a sustainable food system. Intensification of food production must be accompanied by a concerted action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture to avoid further acceleration. And as the summary finishes up there, making these changes, although technically feasible, require urgent, collective and substantially increased action internationally, nationally and locally. So it's a big issue in terms of if we care about global equality and we care about poverty, then this is a major challenge. And that's another report which leads me on to a person I want to show a little bit of now. And this is an argument to say that rather than actually intensifying broad-scale industrial production of foodstuffs and commodities and so on, we actually need to focus on making farmers throughout the world, supporting farmers with the technology and science that they need to become much more resilient and diversified. And so this report says, successfully meeting development and sustainability goals and responding to new priorities and changing circumstances would require a fundamental shift in, this is agricultural knowledge in science and technology, for that, if you know what the acronym means, including science, technology, policies, institutions, capacity development and investment. Such a shift would recognise and give increasing importance to the multifunctionality of agriculture, accounting for the complexity of agricultural systems within diverse social and ecological contexts, require new institutional and organisational arrangements to promote an integrated approach, development and deployment of AKST. It would recognise farming communities, farm households and farmers as producers. It's a different approach to the way in which food is produced in our world. Now, this may seem a bit remote, but it is one of the issues that often comes up in discussion about the way our world is going. How can we feed 7 billion people? And this is suggesting that rather than sort of intensifying our present system, we need a new one. Okay, the person that I think is on next, this is Olivia De Schutter, who until recently was a UN Rapporteur on the right to food. And this is an interview he did at a conference just recently. I heard Olivia De Schutter speak in Melbourne a couple of years ago and was really quite impressed by what he had to say, and I think it's fantastic. And what I liked about it was the encouragement of the agroecological approach, not being a return to traditional agriculture or just simply organic, but rather to actually reflect and understand the way that nature works. If we had time, I'd like to read a quote from Rowan Williams about creativity in terms of creation, because it captures that very well. But I won't do that. Instead, I want to just talk about, or just to introduce, two different specific examples of people I think are embodying that. And they're both Christians. The first one is a first world rich country example. And, of course, the second one will be Tony talking about this agroecological approach in a developing country context. How many people have heard of Joel Salatin? Great, yeah. Amazing sort of character who, through Michael Pollan, has become America's most well-known farmer. In fact, he comes to Australia quite frequently because the numbers of people here have been inspired by him, and he comes and does a lot of seminars, and I hope we'll see some of a little clip from him interviewed on Landline. You can see there from... the picture's not very good, but... he doesn't mind being called a communist, though he self-describes himself as a Christian, conservative, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. But he's also a very smart guy, and his farm in Vermont. And it's quite a story if you want to follow it up. The first part is talking about GMO, which was quite topical when this was done earlier this year. It's good to hear what he has to say about that. But for reasons of time, let's switch to the second part. So... this is a very interesting discussion that he has about ageing farmers and the generational turnover. And in fact, he practices what he preaches, and that's one of the reasons why he's in Australia to do that. But I just find that really quite sort of wonderful that there is a Christian man who is thinking so energetically, creatively, entrepreneurially, but has that sense of actually listening to and learning from God's creation and shaping his production process along that. Okay, now, in a moment I'll just hand over to Tony, but I did want to introduce him a little bit. This is a book by a guy called Mark Hertzgard, who, as you can see, I think it's called Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, and it's about climate change. I think we're not going to be able to get all of the quote there. Most of it, yeah. He says at one point, reporting on climate change is often a cheerless task, but in the Western Sahel, I observed a quiet green miracle that convinced me that all is not lost. Using simple techniques that cost them nothing, millions of small farmers throughout the region have begun protecting themselves against the scorching heat and withering drought of climate change. Their methods amount to a poor man's version of organic farming, fortifying soil with manure rather than chemical fertilisers, growing different crops on the same piece of land, intercropping, relying on natural predators to counter pests rather than applying pesticides. In the process, farmers in the Western Sahel have rehabilitated millions of acres of degraded savanna that was once on the verge of becoming desert, thus increasing the amount of land available to grow food. Goes on to and talks about satellite images which show the amount that's been produced, and saying, yeah, well, it's not going to be it's vulnerable because climate change may wipe out those gains. But then it says at the end, but if some of the poorest farmers in the world can achieve so much, it suggests the rest of us can do even more. And talk about sounding too good to be true, the greening of the Sahel also points to a partial solution to the mitigation half of climate change, the need to slash the amount of greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere. But that's getting ahead of the story. At the moment, suffice to say that farmers in the Western Sahel have achieved their most remarkable success by deploying a secret weapon, often overlooked in wealthier places, trees. Not planting them, growing them. And this quote, this is probably the largest positive environmental transformation in the Sahel and perhaps in all of Africa. And so I think it's worth knowing that what Tony's been doing is actually not just a little thing happening, you know, in some remote developing country, but a major contribution to a continent's response to climate change. But I did, before he talks, I just wanted to, this is from the Tree Whisperer article, which I thought was pretty nice. And you've probably seen that in the Good Weekend a few weeks ago. His Damascus moment when he realised that rather than planting trees, you just need to let the trees that were there already grow. So, Tony, over to you. I think I've left you plenty of time.
Thank you, Ian, and good evening. It's good to be home again. I feel for some of you, you've probably heard at least parts of this story four or five times now, so you're really out there for suffering. But I hope I can add enough new material to make it interesting for you. So probably four major things that made an impact on my growing up years. And the first one was growing up in beautiful Avons Valley in Myrtleford. And just the sheer beauty of God's creation impacted me from as early a time as I can remember. I just love God's creation. The second thing was a little bit more negative. It was man's treatment of creation. And even as a child, not understanding ecology and environment and all the rest of it, it was clear to me that the way we were clear-felling natural forests was wrong. Temperatures were higher, biodiversity was less, there was no habitat for wildlife, there was more erosion, muddying of the streams. All these things were very, very obvious, even to me as a young boy. And it just, I didn't know where people got their priorities from. Not that we shouldn't plant different kinds of crops and trees, but the way that we were doing it was so destructive. The other thing that made me very cross, and I grew up in a region that was famous for growing tobacco, and while our farmers were producing this crop that went up in smoke and killed people in the process, and in growing it, they used a lot of chemicals that were poisoning the air and the water and the soil, children just like me, through no fault of their own, happened to be born in a different place and were hungry. And again, as a small child, it didn't make sense to me, and it made me very, very cross, and it really made me question the values of our own society. And the fourth thing that had a big impact on me was my mum's faith. And I can remember at that time saying a simple child's prayer, something like, "Lord, please use me somewhere, somehow, to make a difference." And I trace everything that I do today and through the years back to that time. Liz and I met at university. We studied agriculture, and we both had a sense of God's calling and leading on our life to serve him in a developing country somewhere in Africa, but we didn't have much idea at that time where it would be and when and how. But after university we were married, and we joined SIM serving in mission and moved to Niger in West Africa. And when we got there, I think we were in a state of shock, because there we were, supposedly the resident experts there to advise and help people to grow more food, and really we didn't have a clue. I don't know about Liz, but I certainly didn't. And this is what people were trying to make a livelihood out of. This land, it's not actually the Sahara Desert. About 20 years prior to our arriving there in 1980, it had been a dry land, biodiverse forest. And when I spoke to my peers at the time when they were growing up, they can remember pools of water lasting throughout the year, wildlife, trees, fertile soil, abundant crops. And in that short space of 20 or so years, it had been reduced to this, and people were really suffering. And there was massive deforestation and desertification. You can see this is millet, their staple crop there. The wind speeds had become so great that crops would get sandblasted or outright buried, and people would plant and replant four or five times. And it wasn't as if they had some magical source of seed. That was their food supply for the year, and they had to keep dipping into that to plant each successive crop after one got buried. And so people, even in a so-called good year, people rarely grew enough food to eat to last them through the whole year. Drought became more severe and more frequent. This, again, millet crop, it's about 3 months old there. It should be 2 meters tall and fully heading out, almost ready for harvest. But in 1984, it barely got much taller than my digger's hat. And we went through famine relief mode 5 separate years during our time living in Niger. We ended up staying there about 17 years. And largely because of the lack of biodiversity, the lack of habitat for natural predators, insect pests of the crops bred up in great numbers, and the whole range of different things. And if it wasn't locusts this year, it'd be caterpillars, and if it wasn't caterpillars, it'd be sapsuckers or some other thing. It's just a biological Armageddon, because there were no natural controls left in the system. And the consequence of all those different things was that people suffered. And we had those severe years when we were involved in famine relief. Usually the menfolk would leave the country, going to neighbouring cities and countries looking for work and food to send back home. And the women and children made do as best they could. And often that wasn't very well good at all. And so I was struggling and probably a little bit conflicted, because I felt called there, and I believe in a good and abundant God, a providing God. And if you look at that verse there, 2 Peter 1:3, God has given us everything that we need for life and godliness through our knowledge of Him. And I take the life bit to be God's provided for our physical needs, and the godliness bit, God's provided for our spiritual needs. And yet, here, living in Niger, it just didn't add up. Maybe this verse was correct for the US or Australia or other more temperate climates, but the reality of what was happening in Niger, it seemed that that verse didn't have any application. But in my heart of hearts, I knew God's word is correct, but I couldn't figure it out at that stage. The longer that I was there, I realized, in fact, even in a place like Niger, God has indeed provided everything that we need. And at one point early in our time there, we had a young nurse who'd given up working at the hospital so that she could do rural health work. And in the time she was waiting for her permission, she just sat with the older people and documented plants and different uses of the indigenous plants that were there or had been there in the past. And by the time her 2 months was up, she'd filled a ring binder with different kinds of useful plants, edible, medicinal, dyes, fiber, all these different things. And even in that stark environment, God had provided, or has provided. We threw the book at the problems. We thought the solution is to engage in tree planting, and we gave it our best shot. And we tried every best practice that we knew of. We consulted widely, we read, we tried to copy other big projects. Everything that we tried was a miserable failure. And it wasn't just us. The government and other NGOs in a 20-year period around that time had spent millions of dollars. They'd planted 60 million trees, and less than 20% of those trees, that, according to their records, less than 20% survived. Having crisscrossed Niger several times, I think that's really optimistic, and there's much, much less than even the 20% there. But we gave it our best shot, and it failed. And this is about into our third year living in Niger. And I was just at the point of a breaking point and thinking, this is hopeless, this is useless. I'm wasting my time, wasting God's time. Better if we just give up and go home. But again, we did feel called there. And I threw up another one of those desperate prayers and said, God, forgive us for destroying the gift of your creation. As a consequence of that, people are suffering. They're poor, they're hungry, they don't know what to do. But you still love us. You sent Jesus to die for us. Show us what to do. Open our eyes. And about that time, we'd been planting trees for 3 years, and you can see them on the trailer. We had a large central nursery. We'd take them out to the villages, have a big planting day of the villages, and then 6 months later, hardly any of them would be left. And we'd been doing that for 3 years. For some reason, I was letting the air pressure out of the tires so we could go through the sand country better that day. I took a closer look at what I'd considered to be just useless bushes. And there's dozens and dozens of them there, even in that slide. I don't know what pricked me that day to get out and have a closer look. But immediately when I got closer, I realized they weren't useless shrubs or weeds at all. Each one was the stump of a cut tree, and the growth there of that tree was trying to get back to its normal position. And in that moment, everything changed, and I realized the battle wasn't against the Sahara Desert. It wasn't about having so many $1 million or so many 100 staff to do the job with or so many years to complete it in. The battle was for the hearts and minds of the people. What was it that drove them to reduce the environment to that state in the first place? What were their beliefs and their attitudes to the environment that brought that about? And in some ways, it's actually easier to battle the Sahara Desert than hearts and minds. But that's where the battle was. And I call this the underground forest because it's not immediately visible there. It's just these little stumps and bushes. And I call it the underground forest because if we had vision to be able to see what's beneath the ground, we'd soon realize that there's almost as much tree underneath the ground as there is above the ground. And for most species, when we cut the tree down, it's not the end of the story. The tree's still alive, it's still got the capacity to regrow, and with a little bit of hope, it can regrow extremely quickly. It's got access to deep water, nutrients in the soil, and it's got a store of sugars in the roots themselves. What's been happening for decades is once that tree's cut, it doesn't have an opportunity to regrow. They're slashed every year as normal part of farming practice. They're browsed during the dry season continuously. People desperate for fuel wood are cutting them, and it never gets that chance. The method's called farmer-managed natural regeneration, and it's actually not a new invention, not something that I necessarily discovered. It's a long-standing tradition. The technical term is coppicing, or in some cases pollarding, if you have a taller stump. And it's a tradition that goes back centuries in many continents around the world. But for us, it was a revelation. It's something that wasn't being done in Niger. The whole focus, and I think the blindness of our paradigms, when you come with assumptions that this is a desert and the only solution is tree planting, it's very difficult to look beyond that or to seek other solutions and even the most obvious solutions that are right there at your feet. But the definition, systematic regeneration and management of trees growing from living tree stumps, sometimes they've grubbed the stumps out and all that's left is some roots that might be sprouting. Often the roots are gone too, and all that's left is some seeds in the soil, but you can regenerate land from either any of those. We can do this on farmland, we can do it on grazing land, in degraded forest land, and I hate this word, I call it potential land, but on so-called wasteland. And it's very, very simple, as that article mentioned. My most sophisticated tool is a knife, and I deliberately use that. It's an older knife, not a brand new shining one, because most people in the third world can't afford a new knife. And I encourage them to use whatever tools are available. In Niger, they simply sharpen their hoes and use them to prune the trees. And the process is very simple. If you have
If you do nothing, there's many, many stems growing from the tree stump, all competing for the same resources. And so the main idea is to reduce the competition. And you might cut it back to just one stem or perhaps up to five and then prune some of the side branches. And the regrowth from that stump can be astounding. The difference, it's not exactly the same site, but this was typical countryside in Niger. Average tree density by 1984 had dropped from 80 trees per hectare to just 4. And that farmland's got none per hectare. But within 3 years, land like that has been transformed into land like that. And land that was very, very low in organic matter and nutrients, because people are now managing the land differently and the plants on that land, they've stopped burning, they've stopped taking off every scrap of straw and organic matter, so the soil fertility can build up, the wind speeds can be reduced and reduce the evaporation rate, so that soil like that can be restored and people can grow half-decent crops. The impact in Niger has been quite significant. This photo was taken in a drought year, and you can see away from the beneficial influence of the tree, many of the millet plants have actually died. And here we've got lower temperatures, higher organic matter. Perhaps there's lizards and spiders capturing insects that are living in the tree. Lots of different reasons why crops and trees can cohabit very well. And it's counterintuitive. Almost all farmers around the world think that they have to get rid of trees in order to grow a better crop. And in many cases, it's because they might see under some species, under some conditions, at the immediate base of the tree, the crop growth is depressed. And in their minds, they think this is bad and we need to cut out all the trees. But generally, the overall impact, if you take the whole field into account, the overall impact is positive. And in the Niger case, where you have such strong winds and such high temperatures and such a low soil fertility, the overall benefit is such that people are doubling and in some cases even tripling their crop yield and having their trees. And the other thing that's changed is people's attitude towards the trees has changed. Whereas before they were seeing the trees themselves as a weed that was competing with their food crop, there's this transformation in their thinking where they're now saying, no, the trees are a cash crop in their own right, and contributing perhaps wild fruits, medicines, fuel wood, building timber, either for home consumption or in many cases for sale as well. So crop yields with the FMNR, with the trees in the fields, at least doubled, and in some cases more than doubled. Livestock that had no fodder available to them for much of the 8-month dry season now had browse from the tree leaves, and in many cases, because people stopped burning, there's more organic matter in the soil, the grasses lasted longer into the year and the grass was of better quality, so the livestock benefited too. And then people with a little bit more initiative could make more money by value adding. If you just sell firewood, you don't make much money at all, but with the same volume of wood, if you turn it into a hut roof or furniture or tools, you might make 4 or 5 times the amount of money. Nutrition improved, not just from the increase in the crop yields, but the wild fruits, the natural nuts and edible leaves and fruits started to return. And while the annual grain crops might provide the bulk of your carbohydrate and some of your protein, the micronutrients and vitamins and other essential food elements would come from these foods that have been missing in their diet for so long. Biodiversity started to increase. So as the trees came back, habitat was restored, and insect-eating birds, the cattle egret, lizards, you can see he's caught a locust there. Praying mantises will not set their yolks at on a grass or on a crop plant. They'll only set their egg sac on a woody plant. So all these creatures which God had provided had disappeared with the clearing of the forest, and now they're slowly starting to come back. It's not that pests immediately disappeared, but there was more of a balance in nature. The farmers had more of a fighting chance of getting a crop in any one year. The impact on the landscape has been quite amazing. So I mentioned earlier the average tree density in the 1970s was about 4 trees per hectare. Sorry, by 1984 it had dropped to 4 trees per hectare. By 2003, the average was about 45 trees per hectare, with some farmers leaving 100, even 150 trees per hectare. And that was just unheard of previously. Grandpa would have turned in his grave to think that his son and his grandson weren't being so-called clean farmers. And yet, farmers were doubling their crop yields and getting the additional income from all the different tree products they're now able to sell. Nationwide, the impact has been staggering. These are independent studies done. So farmers produce an additional 500,000 tonnes of cereal per year, more than in the 70s and 80s. And then from the value that they're generating from the trees and other related products coming out of that FM&R work, total of $900 million per year. So it's been absolutely staggering. Put it in context, on the UN Human Development Index, Niger is the 186th poorest country out of 187 countries. So to increase family income by $1,000 per household in a country like that is very, very significant. In 1999, we come home, and I joined World Vision, and I really felt buoyed up by that story, and I felt, wow, what potential to have an impact globally through an organisation like World Vision. And my personal goal is to see FM&R spread into all 100 countries that World Vision works in by 2020. And in some ways, it's an impossible goal. We've managed to introduce it into about 20 countries, but some of the things that are happening, it's taking on a life of its own, and other organisations and major donors and whole governments are just embracing this and spreading it way beyond what I'm able to do or what we're able to do through World Vision. My first big break within World Vision came through a project that was conducted in Ethiopia. Ethiopia's lost at that time about 97% of its original forest. And I paid a visit to this area in southern Ethiopia in 1999. They were having famine. And in fact, while that year was fairly severe, it wasn't anything new. They'd been having famine to one degree or another since 1984. But I was surprised because we got down there and having recently left Niger, which is on the edge of the Sahara Desert, everything was green and the grass was sort of hip high and the trees were all flourishing, but their maize crop had died. And I'll talk a little bit more about the importance of biodiversity in a little while. But they called it green famine. And one of the contributing factors was the massive deforestation that had gone on in this area. And so we picked, by 2004, we were able to start focusing on reforestation, and we picked this mountain range, about 2,700 hectares, and just started pushing the communities to start adopting this FM&R. This is a Google Earth photo taken this year, and the mountain range really stands out from the rest of the countryside. But it was that project that put FM&R and World Vision's map. And since 2004, I've been enabled through World Vision and the different offices to start promoting this at scale. So in the last 12 months, I've been able to run workshops and conferences in Haiti, in India. We did survey work in Southern Africa in preparation for a major regional conference next April. A national conference was held in East Timor, and World Vision wants to be a centre of excellence, not just for East Timor, but for the whole region that they live in. We've laid the groundwork for a major scale-up in East Sumba. It's one of the drier islands of Indonesia that's nearly almost totally deforested. And people, again, as partly as a consequence of that environmental destruction, people are suffering regular famine through drought and flood and other consequences of that kind of destruction. And in East Africa, where we've established this work since 2012, I'm able to go back each year to help to consolidate that work and guide the progress. This is just one of the countries that we're trying to assist. Zambia is losing 300,000 hectares of forest per year, but it's not untypical of many countries that we're visiting. And so year after year, millions of trees get turned into charcoal. Thousands of hectares get burnt as a normal part of farming, preparation for the next year's planting, and for hunting and other reasons. But all these things are contributing to their own environmental destruction. Partly what we're trying to do through promoting FMNR is to give people alternatives. And the forest is much more valuable to them standing than cut and burnt. And what we're seeing more and more of in different places where the projects are getting established, people have opportunities to promote tourism. Different things that they can harvest and make artifacts from, wild foods, honey, cosmetics. All these different things give people other options, and it's actually much, much more profitable than the little bit that they can make from selling charcoal. This declaration just came out last week that the Africa Drylands Conference, second Drylands Conference held in Chad last year, and I was just blown away. And it demonstrates to me how FMNR has taken on a life of its own. Therefore, they recommend and propose that the Drylands Development Community, through the Africa Union and all collaborating and supporting organisations, commit seriously to achieving the goal of enabling every farm family in every village across the drylands of Africa to be practicing FMNR and assisted natural regeneration by the year 2025. That's staggering. And that goal of ours to reach 100 countries by 2020, it's not so audacious when you see, well, actually, we're not alone in this, and others have taken on the challenge and pushing it much, much further than what we're able to do alone. So I've got another section, but I thought maybe there might be some questions before I move on to that.
I read an article a few weeks ago that says that the countries that are touching the Sahara Desert are planning to create this boundary of trees. It's a multi-country an initiative. And I was wondering if you were involved in that at all.
Not initially.
So we weren't initially, but World Vision collaborates with a number of other significant organisations, the World Resources Institute, the World Agroforestry Institute, and both of those groups have become strong supporters of FMNR. They've been born again in FMNR. And this idea of a green belt stopping the Sahara Desert from moving south, it's not new. It was tried in the 70s and different countries, Mongolia, China, they've all got their own versions of it. In the Sahel, it failed miserably because you're trying to plant trees in even worse conditions than where we were, several hundred kilometres south of the Sahara. They want to do this right on the edge. And so we've been lobbying very, very strongly to change their way of operating and consider FMNR and other sustainable agricultural methods, because they could spend millions of dollars on tree planting and not have anything to show for it. So we are engaged with them. And that declaration, actually, one of the ways that they'll promote that program of FMNR is through the Green Belt movement, the Great Green Wall, yeah.
Tony, you talked about winning hearts and minds, which was more difficult than the actual technology. I read somewhere that it actually required quite a process for farmers to be convinced that coppicing was the way to go, so that you could tell them this is what should happen, but there was some agreement with them, or can you explain that a bit?
Well, it went against everything that they'd been taught by their forefathers, that a good farmer was a clean farmer, meaning chop everything out and burn it. it didn't make sense to them because they didn't actually own the trees on their land, and even if they did protect them, somebody else could come and cut them and benefit. And if there were certain species of trees that were especially protected by the government, even if they didn't cut that tree down, because it was on their land, they could be fined if somebody else did. So it was very, very difficult. And this deeply held belief that trees and crops don't mix, and also a belief that maybe my grandchild will benefit from a tree that I leave, perhaps my son, but I never will, so why bother? So there was a lot of prejudice and misinformation that we were battling. We managed to work with about 10 farmers who were either the village idiots or really understood and went for it. And they were succeeding, it was starting to work, but when it did start to look good and it was having a good impact, people in the village would come at night and steal those trees and they would be laughed at and ridiculed. So it was really going nowhere fast. 1984 was one of those famine years, and the government made a ruling, if you want to distribute food, the people have to work for it if they're able-bodied. And that really played into our hands. So we had a captive audience in about 100 villages who had to practice FMNR for almost a year if they wanted the food, and they really needed the food. By the end of that year, they'd protected 500,000 trees. In September, they got their next harvest. We finished the Food for Work program. Most of the trees got cut out. Two-thirds of them got cut out immediately. Finished with that idiot Tony. Let's get on with our lives. But one-third of the farmers said, no, he's not completely mad. There's something in this. We could still grow food. We had some firewood. The soil seems to be getting better. We're going to persevere. And from that core of one-third, this movement started and grew. And we don't even know how it spread through Niger. We know we played a role. We sent farmers and staff to different places. We invited people to come and learn from us. But the rate of growth, 250,000 hectares per year for 20 years, is just beyond our meagre efforts.
Tony, with the results that you've indicated in Niger, what's the situation now in Ethiopia, and how is that progressing?
So the seeds of a movement have been started there, and whereas in Niger it was a bottom-up process, and it took all of those 20 years to get 5 million hectares reforested, what's happening in Ethiopia is we've got the bottom-up, but we also have the authorities and the NGOs, the research community and the universities and teaching institutions on board. And so we've got this combined effort being thrown at it. And in, I think, March, Liz and I were in Ethiopia and we helped to run a workshop in Oromia region, which is in the Rift Valley, so very deforested, very marginal, semi-arid land. And at the end of that workshop, they committed to protecting, regrowing 100 million trees. 100 million trees, that's just one region. And World Vision works in 5 or 6 regions. They're having these trainings and collaborative efforts in all of those regions. So I think we're going to see something very, very significant there.
Is FNR applicable to a country like Australia? Because we've actually chopped a lot of trees down. Yeah. Can you integrate reforestation and agricultural production, and what would it look like?
Physically, technically, yes, it's applicable. Economically, probably not. In our situation where we're really practicing commercial farming, from an environmental and climate change perspective, it's certainly worthwhile doing. Large parts of our landscape, the tree stumps have been completely grubbed out because of mechanized farming. But even if we did direct sowing of seed and managed the livestock so that they were kept off those areas for a certain period of time, technically it's most definitely possible. I really cringed when Bob Hawke he floated the idea of planting 1 billion trees, because if you just destock for a little while and manage the land differently, in probably most of our agricultural land, the trees would come back.
If I can just add in there, I have heard from some people in Western Victoria who are using FMNR to regenerate trees that have been burnt in bushfires, where they didn't exactly say what they were doing, but I can imagine you might cut the tree down, allow it to reshoot, and then select the good shoots so that it could grow quickly back into a tree.
Tony, the increase in crop yield, could it be, that's an amazing increase, just through having a few trees around on the paddock, and sort of counterintuitive in many ways, but what about the use of fertiliser and other management practices mm-hmm. that might have influenced that difference in yield? Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I think what's happening is you're starting from a very low base. So the average crop yield in Niger is around 250 kilograms per hectare, which is next to nothing. Like in Australia, you would be looking for several tonnes in an equivalent environment. So it's next to nothing. And what it says to me is the trees are bringing back an equilibrium and creating a better microclimate for those crops to grow in. And so if we lift our yield now to 750,000 kilograms per hectare because we've got trees, then if you add other inputs, whether it's organic or chemical fertilizers, then yes, definitely you could go even higher. So I just wanted to spend a few minutes on probably the core things that I've learned over the years about what's required environmentally, what's required from a natural resources perspective to increase food security. And basically my job's really, really easy because there's only four things I need to remember. And they're principles, really. And it doesn't matter if I'm on the edge of the Sahara Desert or the base of the Himalayas or in a tropical jungle, those four principles apply. The species and the exact methods of farming might vary, but the principles are always there. And the first one is the importance of having vegetative cover. All of our food energy comes from sunlight via green plants. Whether we eat plants directly or animal products and the animals have eaten plants, all of our food energy comes from plants. And yet, if you look at the agricultural soils around the world, some 40% of them are degraded or seriously degraded. And by implication, the vegetation's been removed from those areas. And somebody said if this was a burns case, a human body that had been burnt, and they had 40% of their skin destroyed by the fire, then they'd be in a very, very serious condition. And I think the same applies for the earth. 40% of the soil that we depend on for our food supply is degraded. And yet, in the different countries that I travel to, up to 50% of the landscapes that I pass through are highly degraded, no vegetation cover at all. And what that means is that 50% of the land for 100% of the year is producing nothing. And then more and more around the world, people are primarily reliant on annual crops. And in many parts of the world, the rainy season only lasts for 3 or 4 months of the year. So you've got this spatial deficit, 50% of the land not producing, but you've got a time deficit as well where you're only using the sunlight for 3 months of the year over very large areas of agricultural landscapes. And if you look at it at a landscape scale, for much of the year, the sunlight is falling to the earth and bouncing back unused. And yet there's something like more than 30,000 edible plants, many of which are suitable in environments like this, where you can grow food or fibre or some other product on that otherwise unproductive land, either permanently unproductive or seasonally unproductive. You can grow something on that land in many, many situations. I've just put three crops there, but there are hundreds, thousands of different types of crops that could be grown. Taking Niger as an example, where we have a 4-month
rainy season if it rains, and 8 months where the landscape looks like that. So if it rains and you're lucky, under those conditions you might get 200 or 300 kilograms of sorghum or millet per hectare. If we just add one additional species, these ones happen to be Australian acacias. This is the dry season, so the annual crop has already been harvested and there's nothing growing there. They're actually flowering. They'll produce a food crop themselves, but the beneficial impact of having an agroforestry setup where you've got trees and annual crops together, because you've reduced the wind speed, the trees are putting nitrogen into the soil, there's more biodiversity, so pest predators have come and lived in the trees, you actually increase the yield of your grain as well without adding any additional inputs, just by adding trees into the landscape. And the same landscapes that without trees livestock are perishing in, that can be productive all year round. Many trees have edible leaves and seed pods, and they're extremely drought tolerant. They have deep, deep roots, and it doesn't matter if there's a drought, they'll continue to grow and produce fodder. The second thing I look for is the water cycle, and when the environment is intact, the water cycle is intact, so it rains, there's vegetation cover and a good organic soil, and much of that rainfall will soak into the ground and replenish the water table. Springs will flow all year and the streams will continue to flow for days, weeks, even months after the rainfall event. Many, many landscapes have been reduced to this. This is not a desert area. It's the highlands of Ethiopia. It used to be forest. It probably gets 1,000 millimetres of rain a year. But I compare that to a broken water tower. Liz, do you want to do our little show and tell? It's like having a broken water tower. There's no mechanism there to retain the water in the landscape. So immediately when it rains, It pours off, causing a flood downstream. And when the rain stops, within a day or two, you've got an agricultural drought. Nothing soaked into the ground, and the crops are water stressed. If we have a level of tree cover and we restore the condition of the soil, then it's like having a sponge. And it can rain and rain and rain, even quite heavy rain, without any significant runoff. And that water soaking into the soil, it's a natural reserve. The aquifers are being recharged, the springs and rivers will keep flowing. And then if the rain stops, that reserve of water, a lot of it is available to plants, and the soil will remain moist for a long, long time. And if you really squeeze that, it's quite amazing how much water that's holding, and it just keeps going and going and going. One thing that Liz and I have observed as we've travelled to many African countries is, and talking to the local people, even significant rivers that in their lifetime, as far back as people can remember, they were perennial, quite large streams. But what we've seen is they've dried up for most of the year, and springs and wells that people relied on are no longer there. And people blame climate change, they blame drought, they blame God. Very few people point the finger at themselves and say, actually, we're at least partly to blame by what we've done to the environment around us. And so I took these photos. There's only a day between this shot and this one. It wasn't even a heavy rain, but because the land had been denuded, immediately there was a flood off the higher country, heavy erosion. The good agricultural land wasn't usable that year. The crops were waterlogged and killed. The very next day, the stream that should have been flowing for several days after that rainfall event was dry, and that's more and more typical. Where people are combating this, they're having incredible impact. So in northern Ethiopia, where they were threatened by the government with eviction, the government had been feeding them for 30 years consecutively. And they said, we can't maintain this anymore. We're going to take you to a better place. And it really shocked them. They had 1,500-year-old churches there, and their ancestors were buried there, and they said, we're not going anywhere. Let's get off our backsides and do something. And they regenerated the hills. They dug kilometres of these contour ditches, trapping the water. And within 2 years, the water table on the agricultural land rose to within 2 metres of the surface. And they dug 600 wells, and they're growing 2 to 3 irrigated crops per year. So even in a drought year, nobody's talking about leaving. They've done what they called, in their own words, water banking. The water's there in reserve, and we can draw on it at will. And it's revolutionised their community. The other thing, by removing the crop residue, incredible amount of rainfall that does fall is lost through evaporation. And just that simple act of leaving the crop residue on the field can almost completely reverse that. 30 to 50% of the moisture lost in evaporation. The third thing I look for is biodiversity. And in Africa, I'd often ask the ladies for one of their African cooking pots, and I'd get a rock, and I'd try to balance that pot on a single rock, and they'd all be looking at this crazy white guy and laughing at me and wondering what on earth I was trying to do. And I'd say, what's the matter? Doesn't your mum or your sister cook with the pot on one stone? They say, no, of course not. Why? Well, the pot will tip over and the food will spill out. And I'd sort of hit my head and say, oh, really? And then I'd turn it back on them and say, if that's the case, why is it that in this climate that is biased against successful food production, you've got windstorms, you've got drought, you've got insect pests and lots of other things, why is it in that situation that you're primarily relying on one single annual crop? You're so vulnerable. And, of course, they'd laugh and not really have a reason. That's just what they've been taught. But they're vulnerable because they've lost all of the natural biodiversity in that area. And what we try to do in our programs is to not replace their staple crop. That'll always be important to people culturally and in lots of other ways. But can we add other elements in their agriculture so that whatever disaster they're confronted with, drought, pests, whatever, at least some of those components will come through. They'll be resistant to the drought or not attacked by the insects. This was 1999, my first visit to southern Ethiopia. They had a drought year. The farmer had lost probably 90% of his maize crop that year, and two or three of his grandchildren died from hunger-related illness. And we were talking to him. We'd walked through the field and seen the meagre harvest that he'd collected. Then we came back to his compound. You can just see the roof of his hut there. And there's this little, tiny little Garden of Eden. He had papaya. He had a spinach tree called moringa. He had this drought-hardy cassava plant. It's a root crop, different kinds of beans and all sorts of things. And doing the crazy white man thing, I scratched my head and I said, why don't you plant more of these things out in the field? And he looked at the World Vision staff, the Ethiopian staff, and said, tell the white guy, we grow maize. Maize is our staple diet. And I'm not belittling him. That's what they've grown up with, and that's what it's part of their culture, and it's all that they know. But there's also a social aspect to hunger. Often, technically, it's very, very simple to grow more food and be more resilient in the face of different problems that might arise. But the big hurdle is often social. How do you win hearts and minds so that people are more amenable to changing what they've always done? I think we're in great danger. Today, only 150 crops are cultivated, a sharp drop from the 10,000 used over time. And three grains, maize, rice, wheat, and potatoes, provide more than 50% of human energy needs. 95% of food eaten comes from only 30 species of plants. And if we go down the GM route and highly specialized agriculture, that gene base that gives us the diversity that makes us have a more robust agriculture, no matter what the environment throws at it, it's all being eroded away. Now, I take this example from my own garden where I grow at least half a dozen different varieties of tomato. Some of them are early maturing, some of them are late, some of them are more drought tolerant, some of them more insect resistant. So in any one year, I get my tomatoes. Mightn't get all of them, but I get something. And it's not just agricultural crops diversity that's important. The natural environment is extremely important for sustainable agriculture. Even termites, things that people despise, play a critical role in recycling nutrients and breaking down the organic matter and making the nutrients available to plants. Spiders are catching insects and insect-eating birds. So management of biodiversity enables farmers to benefit from 100% of the landscape instead of just 20 to 50%. Enables farmers to be productive for 100% of the year instead of just 25 to 50%. And enables farmers to continue being productive even in the face of environmental shocks such as drought, flood, severe storms and pest attack. So that diversity is extremely important. Most places I visit have a very, very narrow range of crops that they're relying on. Then the last thing that I look for is the nutrient cycle. In an intact environment, when plants and animals die, they decompose and the nutrients are recycled back into the system and reused. In most agricultural landscapes, those cycles have been disrupted. And we're growing food on this depleted soil that's not being replenished. And so in many ways, shouldn't be surprising that people are hungry. This, again, is from my garden when we first moved into Ringwood. And I forgot the samples. I was going to bring some samples of soil that's typical of what I see in the different countries that I go to. It's completely deleted of organic matter and nutrients, but that's what people are trying to survive on. After mulching and adding organic matter for years, the soil's literally become alive. And I just brush the organic matter away, and it sort of bursts into life. I've got tiger worms and these little, they're like a land yabby, and slaters and things. They just scurried everywhere, and it's a self-mulching, self-cultivating soil from that. These figures are staggering. 1 gram of productive soil contains 100 million to a billion bacteria, 25,000 species of bacteria, 8,000 species of fungi. Healthy soil behaves like a living organism, and so on. And yet most soils that I visit that people are trying to grow their food supply from are not living at all. They're dead. They remove the organic matter that sort of drives that life beneath the soil. Here is a type of rhizobium fungus. It actually latches onto the roots of plants, effectively extending its ability to access water and nutrients. And if we take away the straw and the organic matter, then we greatly reduce the numbers of these fungi. And the importance of having nitrogen-fixing plants in the rotation so that you're replenishing the nitrogen supply in the soil. Nitrogen fertilizer is one of the most expensive fertilizers that you can put on the land, and most people just can't afford it. Yet 78% of the atmosphere is nitrogen, and there's a free natural mechanism for putting it into the soil that we're not using because we're not putting legumes in the mix. Over tens of thousands of hectares, people are burning all the crop residue and all the plant material in order to have a clean farm. That's just one shot of one part of Africa, but it would be much the same all over Africa and in many other countries. Destroying the organic matter, destroying the life in the soil that makes soil fertility possible on a massive scale. So why is that child hungry? From a natural resources management perspective, that child is hungry because her life support system, the environment, has been damaged. It cannot provide abundantly as it was created to. That child is hungry because only 50% of the land is converting sunlight energy to usable energy for 30% of the year, while 75% of the rainfall runs off or evaporates. 95% of the available biodiversity goes unused, and 90% of the soils are infertile and biologically dead. Fortunately, like God, the environment is very forgiving and will give us a second chance if we turn from our destructive ways and walk humbly with it.